Hadia knows what this means. Her classmates begin to whisper. They shift in their seats. She hates when anything draws extra attention to her. She already looks so different from them, being the only girl in the entire elementary school who wears hijab. Even when her teacher calls on her for an answer, she blushes. She puts away her notebook, scoots her chair into her desk, and avoids looking at all of them except her best friend Danielle, who waves as she walks out the door. It is likely that nothing is wrong. She takes her time walking down the empty corridor, annoyed at Amar for embarrassing her again, for pulling her from her lesson. Her footsteps echo, and she tries to quiet them by walking on tiptoe. Sentences from classrooms drift from open doors. Grades older than fifth grade, where they are talking about spelling, math, stars, and stories. She pauses at every open door, just to see what those lessons are like. But what if this time it is not nothing? She thinks of grazed knees and broken bones. She thinks of hearing Amar cry out after he has hurt himself, how she recognizes his cry even if she hears it when they are at mosque and separated by a divider. How she rushes down the stairs or through the hallways until she is at his side. How she has to go, even if her parents are around. She quickens her pace. By the time she reaches the corner, she is running, and the reflection of the light bulbs on the floor blur beneath her. The school nurse looks up from her paperwork at Hadia, who arrives breathless, and she welcomes her in with a wave that tells her all is well. Bad news is always delivered in a hurry. "He's in the sick room," she says, and gestures down the hall, though Hadia knows where it is. "He's been calling for you," the nurse says. Hadia knows this too. Amar is lying on the tan bed, wearing red corduroy pants and a white t-shirt, the outfit of his that always reminds her of a little bear. And as he shifts, the paper cover crunches beneath him. The room is cool and gray. He looks fine, suffering only from boredom, blowing the hair in his face so it lifts up and falls on his forehead again. But he stands when she enters and waves at her as if he's been waiting for her to join him at a tea party. "What happened?" she asks. She tries to catch her breath.
"Nothing,"
he whispers in Urdu. He looks like a boy keeping a secret, excited to let her in on it. "Then why are you here? Why did you call me?" she replies in Urdu as well, not wanting the nurse to overhear and confirm her suspicion that nothing is wrong. Her tone is harsh, like her mother's. "I didn't want to be in class," he says, and she glares at him. "And I didn't want to be alone." She had been taking notes for social studies when the call came. They were learning about the American Revolution. She had not finished copying the board, and now it would be erased. She turns to go back.
"It was a hard lesson, Hadia Baji. It made me feel sick."
He only called her sister when he needed something from her.
"Don't go."
Why do things always sound sadder in Urdu? Prettier too. She likes that they speak to each other in Urdu, how even speaking it feels like access to their secret world, a world where they feel like different people, capable of feelings she could not experience, let alone speak of, in English. She turns around and faces him. He looks worried and scratches his cheek.
"He's only six. First grade has just begun, and he has had a hard time adjusting to the longer hours."
The year before Amar started kindergarten, there were 3 days when Mama disappeared, and Baba took them to a family friend's house. Amar was almost four, and it was his first time being away from Mama. Hadia remembers asking Baba where Mama was, as Baba packed a duffel bag of their clothes and toothbrushes. But Baba gave her a silent look that said,
Don't you ask me again. They had never spent the night in anyone else's home before. It was not allowed. Then, as if Baba regretted his look, he told her, Mama was fine, everything would be fine. His face was serious, like it always was, but this time, it was sad too. And when he dropped them off at Seema Auntie's house, even she looked so concerned when Baba passed her their duffel bag that Hadia felt even more alarmed. Hadia watched Huda and Amar follow Seema Auntie into her big house. Even the fact that it was so big frightened her. What if they got lost, and Baba could not find them when he came back? Baba placed a hand on her shoulder. He told her he would be back to check on them tomorrow evening after work.
It is your job as the big sister to take care of them, he told Hadia. You are like their mother when Mama is not here.
Hadia held onto her arm and pinched her skin so tight she had no space to feel sad about what Baba was saying.
I know you will do a good job, Hadia. I'm certain, Baba said.
Then he leaned down to kiss her forehead. She had the ugly thought that she would be okay not seeing Mama for a day or two if it meant that Baba believed in her. But when Baba pulled his car from the driveway, Amar realized he was not coming back, and that Mama was not coming that night either. And he latched onto Hadia fiercely and screamed if she tried to pry herself from him. But he did not ask for Mama once, and Hadia wondered if he understood something that she did not. The next day, Hadia couldn't go to school because Amar cried when she put her socks on and screamed when she zipped up her backpack. He even threw things, and Hadia was so embarrassed because now Seema Auntie would know about his misbehaving. Seema Auntie called Baba, and Baba told her Hadia could stay at home with him. So everyone went to school, Huda and Seema Auntie's sons, but Hadia stayed back with Amar and Seema Auntie's baby girl, who was almost two and learning how to speak. If Amar watched TV, he looked at Hadia every few minutes, as if he were afraid she too would disappear if he looked away for too long. When she went to the bathroom, he waited outside in the hallway until she emerged again. Seema Auntie let Hadia play with her son's video games. Amar threw a little ball that squeaked at the baby girl, and the baby girl laughed. Hadia liked to pick her up and point to things and name them, and the girl repeated the words back to her. Light, fire, tree. Amar pointed to his nose and said his name, and the girl tried to say it, but said Mar instead. And that was the first time Hadia and Amar laughed, knowing it was the Urdu word for hit or hurt. In the evening, when Baba visited, Hadia watched him carefully for signs of what was going on. But he just looked tired, or like he was just pretending to be there with them. When Baba got ready to leave, he hugged Hadia and Huda and stood for a long time watching Amar sitting on a couch, his back to Baba. Hadia tried to look at Amar's back too, tried to see what Baba was looking at there, but saw nothing special.
You should be so proud of Hadia, Seema Auntie said to Baba. She helps so much, it is like I hardly have to watch them at all.
Hadia waited for Baba to react, but instead, he nodded and said he had to go. Hadia watched the headlights of the car pull away, and all the terror she had felt the night before came rushing back. Even though she knew that Seema Auntie was nice to them, that her baby was cute, that the food tasted like Mama's, and the boys in the house shared their toys with them. Those days were the first times she really felt like a sister, like it was a job she had to do, and that she would do her best at it. And after, she never stopped feeling it. She took the job as seriously as listening in class or cleaning the kitchen counter when Mama passed her a dishcloth. When Amar cried and shook his head if Seema Auntie tried to spoon rice into his bowl, Hadia sat up in her chair, took the spoon, and served him, remembering what Baba had told her. She did not let Huda tease Amar. She thought of games they could play together. She told them stories before they went to sleep. The one they liked about when the prophet split the moon, or the one about the two children who get lost in the woods but find their way home by sticking together and by dropping breadcrumbs.
You're good at telling stories, Seema Auntie's oldest son, who was Hadia's age, told her.
He was nice, but Hadia kept forgetting his name.
My mama tells good stories, she told him proudly. And that was the first time she missed mama. And she felt bad that it had taken her so long to miss her when Amar missed her every day. By the third day, Amar was calmer. Maybe he knew that, whoever else left, Hadia would not. Or maybe he was bored with her and wanted to play with the toys that filled the big house. Hadia left his side and spent the whole day playing with Huda and Seema Auntie's three boys. She took breaks to check on Amar, and he was fine, helping Seema Auntie by carrying snacks to them outside or playing with the baby girl when Seema Auntie was busy cooking. The baby girl followed Amar around the house, and when she reached across to scratch his face, leaving a long red line that raised instantly, Hadia was impressed that Amar, despite having not spent time with many toddlers, knew not to hurt her back, and he just laughed. In the garden, the oldest boy asked Hadia where her parents were, digging in the dirt with the edge of a long stick, and she said she didn't know. Inshallah, God willing, they'll be back and all will be well, he said. And Hadia thought that it was weird that a boy her age was talking to her like the grown-ups, and she told him so. He shrugged and said he was just trying to be nice. He had green eyes, and in the sun, she saw specks of gold and orange in them. That was before Hadia started to wear a scarf, and she played soccer with the boys in the backyard, their lawn that was as wide as a park. He was rough with his brothers, but slowed as he approached her and passed her the ball gently. That night, Baba came back and told her to get her things, and Hadia knew that Mama was home. She was surprised to find that she didn't want their visit to be over. Amar held her hand while they walked to the car, and she turned around to wave at the boy whose name she had forgotten, and he stood on his doorstep, waving back. At home, Mama was sitting on the couch, and Hadia stopped walking when she saw her, because Mama looked so much smaller. She looked back at Baba to see if he thought she looked strange too, but Baba looked as he had for the past few days, like only his body was with them. She felt obligated to hug her mother. Once Amar climbed into her lap, he did not leave it, and he refused to look at Hadia. She watched the two of them, the way Amar followed Mama, the way Mama did not put him down but carried him from room to room, even though he had become too old for that. Hadia ran upstairs and wished her mother had not come back, then felt so awful for thinking it that she began to cry, and she said to God, "I'm sorry, please forgive me." In the weeks that followed, Amar hesitated before responding to her, as though her presence now reminded him of Mama's absence. When Amar began first grade and the school days grew longer, Amar would call Mama to pick him up right after lunch, and he would go home early. But that made Baba too angry. He hit Amar once with the shoulder of a hanger and told him that he had to stop being a baby, that he had to stay in school for the full day like everyone else. And after that, Amar had only called for Hadia.
In the nurse's room, she takes a seat next to him. The tissue paper crumples beneath her weight. He thanks her, speaking in English again.
"Your lip looks funny," he says, twisting his mouth to one side.
She presses her tongue against the bruise.
"Is it from last night?"
he asks.
Hadia does not say yes.
Recently, Amar has begun sensing when Baba gets even a little irritated with her or with Huda, and he acts out in a way that guarantees Baba will only get angry at him. If Huda complains about the dinner and Baba gives her a look, Amar will chime in, say he does not just dislike the dinner, he hates it, until Baba is only looking at Amar, willing only Amar to test his patience.
"It's just a small bruise," she says.
The clock ticks. The nurse types in the other room, hitting the keys quickly and loudly. "Once there was a boy who cried wolf," she tells him again. The whole village rushed to his side. His sister too, who was afraid for him. But when they reached the clearing and there was no wolf, only a boy with a mischievous look on his face, people thought to themselves, "Now we can't trust this boy's word. Next time when he calls wolf, 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 we will look away. We will busy ourselves." Amar blows at the hair on his forehead like he's not even listening to her. "And eventually," she adds, trying to make her voice very serious. Even his sister convinces herself that she should not listen to the boy, that there is no wolf, and she should just keep taking notes in class instead.
"I don't believe it," he says.
"You don't have to believe it. It's the lesson part that's true."
"What is the lesson?" he asks.
"They stop going to help him. He gets eaten by the wolf, because the whole time he said it was there when it wasn't. So they didn't believe him when the wolf actually did come."
Before she leaves, she will tell him that he has to stay in class, no matter how hard it is, and that he can't disturb her classes anymore.
"But you would not do that. You would still come," he says at last.
She gives up. She wonders how long she will have to stay until Amar is calm, until he's ready to go back to class. She rubs the marks her nails made on her arm with her thumb.
"Why do you always do that?" he asks her.
She pulls down the sleeve of her sweater until it covers the marks. She feels as though he has uncovered one of her secrets. She watches the hand on the clock move.
"Hadia?"
"Hmm."
"Don't tell Baba, please."
"I won't." They sit. There is nothing left to speak about. Even though he was lying about his tummy hurting, he holds two arms folded over it anyway. He really does look like a little teddy bear. His feet don't touch the floor, and he swings them back and forth. He leans his head against her arm, and she looks at the poster in the nurse's room, of the body and the food it needs to eat to be healthy. And she studies it, thinking that if she memorizes at least one fact, her time will not be wasted. Every weekend, there are countless functions and family-friend parties, and Amar hates almost everything about them. The ceaseless small talk, the constant gaze of his father following him, making sure he's treating elders with respect, that he is not fighting with or being vaguely rude to the other boys his age, or disappearing with the few he is friends with and offending the host, sometimes to smoke a cigarette a few streets away, sitting on the curb and complaining with them about everyone else, mints at the ready in their pockets. Other times, just to drive to the nearest 7-Eleven and get a soda, despite the endless supply of soda at the party, just for the thrill of that ride, for that momentary escape, for the pleasure derived from the click of the ring pull on the can that is his, purchased by him in secret.
He detests, most of all, the importance placed on maintaining a sense of decorum that feels stifling, false. Always the same menus, the same combination of dishes. Even the segregation annoys him. Males confined to one side of the house, females to another. Sometimes divided by a wall or a cloth pinned between walls. But still, he would go. Because Abbas would be there, as well as Amira's other brothers. And maybe one of them would bring her up in conversation. He would catch snippets, little clues that he could piece together. From them he learned how she loved peanut M&Ms, because Abbas would purchase a packet for her every time he went to the 7-Eleven, and how she wanted to go to college on the East Coast in a few years, had already begun improving her grades and researching schools despite the resistance of her parents. How she hated the sports her brothers watched. How she did not shy from fighting with her middle brothers, and that she demanded her parents treat her the same as them. And of course, he could not resist the pull of the possibility that she would be there, that he might catch the sound of laughter that was hers, note the shoe in the pile of shoes that was hers. If the timing was right, if all aligned, if he stood near the divider, just as someone was passing with a tray of food or jug of water and they lifted the curtain, and if she happened to be standing behind it, maybe he would catch a quick glimpse of her, her delicate features, her slender body, always clothed in bright colors. Today, at yet another function hosted by a family friend, he walks into the backyard and leans against the rough wall. Young women have found seats at the garden table. One glance informs him. Amira is sitting with them, in the center, dressed in a midnight blue shalwar kameez, sipping coke from an orange and white striped straw, her hair cut shorter than he recalls. She is one of the few young women who does not wear hijab, does not even pretend to during gatherings. The young women are all laughing, as if trying to get his attention in obvious ways. He sees only her. The girls whisper among themselves, and she looks up at him. She blushes, looks away. He turns to the thin telephone wires cutting across the sky, focuses on the little birds perched on them to avoid looking at her, and puts his headphones on and begins to play a song. His father had been engaged in a conversation with boring Samir uncle, meaning he would be occupied for a while. But he still looks once to the sliding door to make sure no one is coming. Headphones alone are enough to ignite his father's anger, an anger that will fester during the party, escalate to a fight in the car, and become a disaster by the time they reach home. He attempts to appear as though he wishes he were anywhere but here. He knows it is a lie. This moment, that one glance, the color that rose to her cheeks, the way it suited her. It is the best thing that has happened to him this week. When he thinks that his luck at being in her presence unnoticed is sure to run out soon, she stands. The folds of her clothes fall and straighten. She walks toward him. He tries not to look. Birds on a wire, one flapping its wings, rising into the sky. The girls she left, still seated at the table, have stopped giggling to watch her walk. They meet each other's eyes. Some turn to one another to whisper. Others would consider her steps indecent. He thinks her bold. Bold to stand. Bold to leave the flock of women. Bold to be beside him, at a gathering full of community members, all with a penchant for exaggerated, condemning gossip. Bolder, he thinks, than he could ever be. He lowers the volume of his song with every step she takes, just in case she speaks when she reaches him. And when she does speak, when she asks a question so simple, "What are you listening to?" he realizes that though he may not have known it until that very moment, he has been waiting his whole life for her to walk through the crowd of whisperers and speak to him. Amira, with her laugh louder than the others beyond the partition. Amira, running in a game of tag in the mosque parking lot, so fast that neither he nor the other children playing could ever catch her. He removes a single earbud, keeping the other in, an attempt to appear nonchalant. He had been listening to a song he did not think anyone knew, had chosen it because it reminded him of her. He tells her its title. Her face lights up, and she tells him that she knows it, her voice quickening. This must be how she is when she is excited. And sure enough, she tells him she loves it, with such generosity of expression that it takes him by surprise, that someone could be capable of being moved in that way by something so small. He almost smiles. She asks him if he wants to know her favorite line. At the realization that there could be nothing about her he would not want to know, he suddenly feels shy, a word he has never used to describe himself before. He raises an eyebrow and waits. Unbothered by his reticence, she shares the line. He looks at her then and says, "Mine too." It turns into a game. One question leads to another. Back and forth, they try to find things that connect them. They have the same first initial. Amar offers this one. Even the fact that his sisters shared the same initial had felt to him as a child like an exclusion. "Do you like waking up before the rest of the world? Do you wake up in the middle of the night after a bad dream and find that you cannot remember it, but you can taste having had it? When you stand in prayer with everyone, all in a line, does your mind wander? Do you try to break those thoughts, stop them but can't, and everything you've ever wanted to think about comes spilling out? Do you feel then like you're pretending, like you are the weakest link in the chain of worshippers? When you were little and you caught sight of the moon from the car window, did you feel like it was following you? And what do you see when you stare at the moon? Do you see a face or Imam Ali's name in Arabic? Does your father's voice shake the walls? Would you run away if it weren't for your siblings? Do you like to catch glimpses into strangers' living room windows? Wonder what their life is like? Do streetlights make you sad too?" At that, she confesses, so unguardedly that he hopes he will remember it. "Sometimes I sit on my bed and focus on the closest streetlight when I don't want to cry, when the day has been long, when I feel the stillness, that feeling of being awake when no one else is." In this new game, they do not respond to their responses, so he moves on to the next question. "What is one thing you're afraid to lose?" Her mother's sharp voice from the open sliding door startles them both before Amira can answer. Seema Aunty looks at the two of them and frowns. Amira rushes inside, aware that she has stayed too long. She does not dare turn back to look at him. That night, he stares out his window, at the quiet street and magnolia tree, at the streetlight a few houses down, and tries to picture her looking at one just like it. The moonlight illuminates the white painted wood that frames his window. With the thin tip of a pushpin, he carves out her initial, A, then realizes again that his is the same as he carves another beside it. And he feels as though he is committing his affection to the world, that a decision has just been made. He hopes that tonight is not a night that she has sat up in her bed and focused on her streetlight, hopes that the look her mother gave them when she saw them talking hasn't led to trouble. And if she is awake, on the other side of the city, he hopes she can sense that he is awake too. He looks down at the initials, as if for the first time, as if he had not realized what he was doing until it was done. And he takes comfort in how thin the strokes are, how almost indistinguishable, how no one but he would ever notice them there, carved so close together that they appear not like two letters, but an M with a line cutting through it, or two mountains with snow that has fallen on a straight line. 2. Layla opens her eyes to the softest morning light and Rafiq's face, so close and half obscured by his arm. He will remain asleep until their alarm rings, or she reaches out to touch his shoulder. All night she woke to the dark, then blue light, and knew there was still time. Turned around to try and fall asleep again. But the light that comes through their still curtainless windows now fills their whole room, washes out the shadows. White comforter and white pillowcases, and Rafiq's dark hair and dark lashes and dark skin she often feels affection for. Odd to feel affection for the color of his skin, but it is true. There is something comforting about it. Layla feels nauseous. He is leaving in a few hours. His small suitcase is ready and waiting by the front door. 3 days, 2 nights. The first time he has to fly to another branch, a city 6 hours away. It was a requirement of his promotion. From now on, he would leave for days at a time, every other week almost. And Layla knows she should be proud of him and happy for what it has allowed them. Purchasing a used car that would be hers, moving just a few weeks prior into their new home, an actual house, still oddly empty and quiet to her, as if it were a size too big, and Layla unsure if her life would ever expand enough to fill it. Soon, Layla will leave the warmth of their bed to pack Rafiq's lunch, and Hadia's and Huda's too. And Rafiq will sweep Hadia off to preschool and Huda to a daycare they are trying for her, because she also wants to have somewhere to go with a backpack. Then Rafiq will drive himself to the airport, and she will continue unpacking in the empty house, attempting to create a home. What will it be like for her to fall asleep tonight without him? She cannot remember the last time she slept alone. Before Rafiq, her bed had been an arm's length away from Sara's. Tonight, she will be the one to go from room to room, closing windows and locking doors, checking them twice, turning off all of the lights. She will have to become comfortable driving at night. She has only ever driven in the daytime, when he was not there. She never thought of him as responsible for doing these things until now. She moves closer to her husband, breathes in his scent. So familiar that she never notices it anymore. Almost 5 years into their marriage, unless she seeks it out. His most beautiful face is his sleeping one. No stern expressions. Just eyelids, lashes, defined nose, jawline. She pictures those cartoon cottages and shows her daughters watch, where a woman inside the cottage throws open the shutters and appears at the window singing. That is how it feels today to wake up and see his face, like a window in the room of her heart is being thrust open. Rafiq stirs. Layla shuts her eyes, not wanting him to see her looking at him. What is it about caring for another? Feeling love, feeling affection, at times desire, that makes one shy. Even in front of her own husband, she feels that hesitation of expression. Is it time? He asks. How he knows she is awake. Yes, I think so. She rises to wake the girls. Her sight goes black for a moment, and she stands very still, presses her fingers to her eyelids until she feels steady. She must be stressed, which is natural. They're all growing accustomed to the new home and the new city, slowly getting to know the mosque community. Hadia has just started preschool, 3 days a week, for only 3 hours, but still, the emptiness of her home is new to her. From their doorway, she watches her little girls sleeping in their shared bedroom. Who am I without them? She wonders, having become so used to them. Her husband's face in the morning, her daughter's steps throughout the day. Her girls are easy to wake. She is a lucky mother. They do not resist or fuss. She only has to walk in and move the blanket off their bodies, and they begin to blink, rub their eyes. "Wake up, wake up," she sings, and leans in to kiss Hadia's forehead. She taps her little nose until Hadia sits up and yawns. Leila reminds her she is in charge of helping Huda with the morning routine. The brushing of hair, of teeth, the changing into clothes Leila will have laid out on their beds by then. Hadia nods. She is Mama's little helper. She rises to every occasion.
"Mama, is Baba leaving today?"
she asks, a startled expression on her face, as if she has just remembered. Hadia looks down at her nails. Leila allowed her to paint them for the first day of preschool a few days ago, and now they are a chipped, bright pink and deep purple. Hadia scratches a nail with another, chipping it even more, and Leila places her hand on hers to stop her. "It will be okay," she says, her voice deep and slow to assure her daughter. "We will be fine. We will even have fun." Hadia searches her face, as if she's trying to sense if Leila is being honest or if she's only trying to comfort her. She is smart for her age, perceptive and easily affected. Leila has to be careful. Finding what she was looking for in her mother's face, Hadia nods, hops out of bed to wake Huda. Downstairs, Leila listens for the sounds of her family's movements as she fills clear plastic bags with slices of pear or bunches of grapes and a handful of goldfish crackers. She packs juice boxes, makes wraps of roti filled with fried okra, and carefully covers them in foil, rough and silver. That is Huda jumping off of the bed onto the floor. She must be dressed. She likes putting her clothes on while standing on her bed, and Leila often admonishes her. It is so easy to lose balance. The distant rush of water on its way to the shower slows and stops. Rafiq must be stepping out. 3 brown bags of lunch, all in a line. Sliced pear for Huda, grapes for Hadia, almonds for Rafiq. And she pauses to look out the window at their garden. A square of cement where the girls play jump rope. Then lots of long and unkempt grass, and at the far end, a lone plum tree. She had liked the plum tree when they first moved in, had warmed to the idea of owning land which contained a tree that would bear fruit. Pounding footsteps on stairs, and she knows that Huda and Hadia are racing to her, and she turns just in time to see them, Hadia in the lead, Huda trailing after her, out of breath, and already unhappy, a defeated look on her face. "No running," she reminds them. But there is no point. The race is already over. They are clambering into their chairs. Hadia has won again. Leila wishes she would let her sister win once in a while. Leila pours cereal into their matching pink bowls and sets it before them. Huda complains. Hadia spills some milk on her shirt. Leila just concentrates on slicing a banana into Rafiq's cereal bowl. Every time the dull blade of the butter knife reaches her palm, she pushes softly into her skin, feels its ridges. When they first bought the home and walked through it as a family, Rafiq pretended that they had come upon the house by a complete accident. "Do you think the door will be open in this house?" he asked Hadia as they pulled into the driveway. They had just listened to their Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan cassette, and Leila loved the way it lightened Rafiq's mood. Hadia looked at him from her booster seat, skeptical and excited, old enough to understand his game, young enough to be fooled by it. Rafiq lifted Hadia up and onto his shoulders. Hadia adored when he did this, her face all love and wonder. This time, some fear too.
"Baba, don't. What if you get in trouble?"
"Don't become worried," he said. "You trust your Baba, don't you?" And she paused for a long second before she nodded. And what a surprise. The door opened. And look how silent and empty the house was.
"No one lives here," Hadia whispered, tense but intrigued.
"You're exactly right, Hadia," he said. "Smart girl." And she beamed. Rafiq paused in every room. "Kitchen," he said to Hadia, and she nodded. "Space where the kitchen table would be," he said to the emptiness beneath a light fixture. And Huda, almost 3 years old, looked at it all with boredom, a thumb in her mouth that Leila kept pulling out. He led them straight to the backyard. Their old apartment only had a tiny balcony. And Leila thought to reach out and hold Hadia as he twisted the lock to open the sliding door. But he was careful, balancing her with one arm. Leila followed them closely. Hadia's arms were wrapped tight around his neck. They trudged through the grass, and Rafiq spun once, and Hadia giggled. And it was possible that Leila wished, for a moment, that he were leading her with as much care through their new home as he was Hadia. But this was silly. To give her daughter love was a way to give her love. When they reached the farthest end of the backyard and turned to look at the expanse before them, that would be their grassy yard and the two-story house, Rafiq paused, looked up at Hadia and asked,
"Do you like this house?"
"Yes,"
Hadia said, and she leaned her chin on his head. Her hair fell just above his ears.
"Could you live here?"
he asked. And Leila thought it was sweet. They had already bought it weeks earlier, had just gotten the keys that day. But he was presenting it to Hadia as if he would make it hers in that instant if she said yes. Leila hoped she would say yes.
"I guess so," Hadia said.
Rafiq lifted his shoulders and lowered them abruptly, just as he had when she was a little younger, and he was pretending to be a horse or a helicopter, and Hadia started laughing her uncontrollable laughter.
"You guess so, you guess so?"
Rafiq stretched for one of the plums on the plum tree and plucked it for her, passed it into her hands.
"It's yours."
"Plum?"
"All of it."
He spun her. He nodded at the empty house. He put her down and lifted up Huda and said,
"Did you hear that, Huda Jan? This house is yours."
And Hadia just stood there, stunned, holding on to that little plum and looking up at Rafiq with big eyes and her mouth a little open. Huda looked like she did not understand, but Rafiq looked happy, and Hadia seemed happy, so she smiled too, then put her thumb back in her mouth. Now Rafiq has taken his seat beside the two of them at the table and is scanning the newspaper as he eats. The girls are not allowed to speak when he's reading the paper. They know this. They listen to him without even being told. They give each other looks, and Leila wonders what they communicate to each other. Why is he not talking to her? If this is his last morning with them, with her? She is too nauseous to eat with them. So she stands at the counter and looks for reasons to stay in the room, clears the surfaces, wipes them down with a sponge, looks up from time to time at the morning sunlight on the page of Rafiq's newspaper, and the light in his dark hair. The light catching the curve of the silver spoon he holds away from him. Then he pulls back his sleeve to look at his watch. And it is his father's watch. He had worn it on their wedding day, and on the day they had flown together to America. Her heart pinches to think she has glimpsed what he did not verbalize. That this is not nothing to him either. That perhaps he is nervous for the new position, or wants to take a piece of his father with him. Rafiq rises from the table with his empty bowl in hand, gathers the girls' bowls too, tells them to grab their backpacks. It is time to go. Will he pause to embrace her? Will he look back from the doorway, lift his hat, or nod his head before leaving? Leila hugs the girls before she remembers the Quran, how Rafiq should walk beneath it if he is going on a journey, and she tells him this, and he appears agitated. There is not much time. So Leila rushes up the stairs to the empty room next to their daughters, which they have been using as a prayer room. Two prayer rugs, each with one corner folded over, and a tiny bookshelf with all their religious texts. And she grabs the Quran she likes, with the blue cover and golden pages. Downstairs, Rafiq is waiting in the doorway. The girls presumably buckled into the car. And she holds the Quran up with one arm and instructs him to walk back and forth beneath it 5 times, as her mother taught her. As her mother had done for her on every first day of school, and on the day after her wedding, when she was taking off to fly to America. And by the 4th time Rafiq walks beneath, her stretched arm begins to ache. And by the 5th, he pauses, looks up at her, and she holds the Quran up to his face, and leafs through all the pages at once, its breeze causing the hair falling onto his forehead to tremble. And he leans in and kisses the cover with closed eyes. There is a pause. Leila does not know what to say or ask for.
Make sure all the windows are closed when you leave to pick up the girls, and check at night too, and the doors.
I know.
Even the garage door.
Yes.
Khuda hafiz, he says,
which is goodbye. But literally it means, in God's protection I leave you, in his care I trust. And it is that meaning she intends when she responds in kind.
You will be fine, he says.
She nods. How she appreciates that he knew what she needed and acknowledged it. He kisses her, ever so softly, on her forehead and steps away. Leila lifts a hand in goodbye. The door closes, the house empty, the sound, after a few seconds of the car turning on, of the tires pulling away on the cement. At night, the girls brush their teeth together in front of the bathroom mirror, balancing on their individual stools. Huda is always in a rush to spit out the toothpaste, but waits for Hadia to be done before she lowers her own brush. And Hadia nods her head slowly as she counts to 100 in her head. Leila hates how night looks outside windows without curtains. She is exposed. She avoids going near them. She turns the lights off downstairs and finds she is a bit out of breath by the time she reaches upstairs. Hadia and Huda are getting into their pajamas. They are what fills her life. They really are, she thinks. What would life be like with another child? When Rafiq called earlier, she did not tell him that she threw up 2 times after he drove away, or that she lay in bed for an hour absolutely miserable before the queasiness passed. She doesn't know if it could be true, that after a year of trying she might have another child soon. But instead of the immediate excitement she had felt with her girls, the possible news made her feel even lonelier as she went about her day, picked up her daughters from school, cooked dinner, no hope of seeing Rafiq for 3 days. And what if she was carrying a child again, and he was so often away? Hadia and Huda crawl into their beds, and she notices for the first time that the tree outside their bedroom scrapes against the window when it is windy. She begins to read to them, but stops, tries to keep her voice even when she asks, "Do you girls want to do something fun tonight?"
"Yes, yes," Huda says, so excited without even knowing what.
"Do you want to camp in my room?"
"Yes."
Huda stands up in her bed and jumps up and then onto the floor. Leila follows as the two of them race into her room. They climb onto her bed. Instinctively, they know to scoot to the side that is Rafiq's. Their small heads share his pillow. They look at Leila, as if waiting for instructions, waiting to see if there is a next part to this spontaneous plan. But there isn't. Leila says goodnight to the two of them, then moves her prayer rug into her own room, and she prays in the corner while the girls try to sleep. They shift around. She did lock the front door and checked twice. She does not need to go down again. She will ask Rafiq to install curtains when he returns. She is a little thirsty, but she can cup her hands and drink from the sink. She catches her reflection in the bathroom mirror. Her face is older now, but still young. She is 26, young enough to carry another child without complication, if she is lucky, if God wills it. Old enough to be able to do this. Spend this night beside her girls who are warm and full of life. It is to be expected that the first night apart from Rafiq would be a bit difficult, that she would feel uneasy when she looked out the glass to the dark night sky and saw only her reflection, expected that she would be startled while reading the girls to sleep by the sound of a passing car, its lights curving up and across their walls. She climbs into bed quietly, thinking her daughters are asleep. Hadia opens her eyes.
"Awake?"
Leila whispers. Hadia nods. She looks up at the ceiling. Her nose looks so blue and small in the dark. Her tiny hands beneath her cheek, her palms together, like a photograph of a child resting.
"Mommy," she says, pausing to sigh. "I really love school."
She says it all in English, and like she is confessing, like she is attempting to make conversation, or is surprised it is this way for her when she did not expect it to be.
"Mommy,"
Leila says. She is startled to be called that.
"Mummy,"
Hadia corrects herself, embarrassed. "I'm glad to hear that," Leila says. They always speak in Urdu. She might have to make a point to enforce it as a rule now. Should she call Rafiq tomorrow, tell him this? That their daughter was speaking like an adult too?
"Did you like school?"
Hadia asks. Outside, the wind whips through the trees. Leila kisses her cheek, moves Hadia's hair around gently. All praise to God, she thinks, as she looks at her. All thanks to him for the gift of my daughter, Sweet, and I having the privilege of being her mother.
"Shh," she says into her daughter's hair. "Sleep. I did like it. I liked it a whole lot. We can talk about it tomorrow."
Hadia nods and closes her eyes. Leila leaves her arm over her daughter's body. It feels safe and comforting just to have her there. Hadia is 13 and sitting on top of a picnic table painted red, loosening the knot of her scarf and watching the boys from her Sunday school class play basketball during their lunch break. Amar is among them, despite being much younger. She focuses on him from time to time to make sure he is keeping up with them, that they're not shoving him or denying him the ball. But her brother holds her attention only briefly before she returns to follow the movement of the eldest Ali boy, who weaves through the rest of the boys with an ease that looks graceful to her. From where she watches, it appears that the others are afraid of him, or in awe of him. They seem reluctant to steal the ball. They cheer louder when he scores. And he scores often. She tugs at the knot of her scarf again. It is a hot day. Abbas Ali, the eldest Ali boy, is the only one in the entire community Hadia has spent years maintaining a secret admiration for. She is not alone. The other girls have not been nearly as reticent. Already, he has a reputation in the mosque among the girls. He is kind to the youngest girls, pathetically adored by the girls his age, and even the older, teenage girls tend to comment on how incredibly good-looking he will be when he grows up, sometimes to his face, because he is 13 and so much younger than them, and that kind of compliment is not yet inappropriate. Hadia is among the adorers his age, and her mosque friends share anecdotes about him in the bathroom, magnifying his inconsequential actions.
Did you see how he asked Zainab if there was any tea left in the ladies' section?
She finds them foolish. She has no interest in engaging with the other girls and their childish fervor, their embarrassing giggles and obvious whispering. She refuses to add to his awareness of the effect he has on girls, refuses to speak out loud her thoughts on the matter. She has not even told Huda, with whom she shares everything. To speak of it would be to lessen what she is beginning to feel. She's ashamed by how she watches him, by the details she notices, the sweat that glistens on his neck, the way he wipes his forehead with the back of his hand, his voice commanding the other players on the court, how they listen to him, and how, when the voices drift toward her, she knows which one is his. The few seconds when he lifts his shirt to wipe his face. She looks away then, before looking back, despite herself, a heat rising to her face. He is still young, skinny, she thinks. She is still just a girl, crooked teeth and bushy eyebrows, dressed in loose clothes her mother picked for her, a shirt that falls just above her knees, jeans a size too big, to ensure any hint of her body is hidden. Not the kind of girl a boy like the eldest Ali boy would ever notice. But still. The boys stop to take a break. Some head for their water bottles, and others lean forward and rest their hands on their knees, breathing heavily. Amar picks up the basketball before it rolls off the court and stands beneath the hoop, begins to practice. The eldest Ali boy looks over at the picnic table. At her. She looks away. After the bell rings, she takes her time walking into the mosque where their classes are held. The other girls go on ahead, their steps quickening from the awareness that Quran class is next, and the Arabic teachers are all so strict and punctual. Hadia fiddles with her scarf, untying it and retying it again. The knot under her chin feels heavy whenever she thinks of it. In the lobby that contains cubbies for all the shoes, she removes hers slowly, loops two fingers in the straps, and tucks them away. The lobby is the only section of the mosque, besides their classrooms during Sunday school, that isn't segregated. Everyone seems to slow when they are in the lobby, linger, wanting to take advantage of the brief moment when the veil between the genders is lifted. The boys who played basketball file in, sweaty and playfully shoving one another and kicking off their shoes before running to class. They do not notice her. The eldest Ali boy enters, and next to him walks her brother. Amar is looking up at him in the way he would often look up at Hadia, when they were younger and her ability to make up new games mystified him. He has not looked at her that way in months, has stopped hovering in her doorway before his bedtime to tell her some trivial detail of his day. As they approach, Hadia is suddenly more aware of herself, if only because of the eldest Ali boy's presence in the room. This is my body, she catches herself thinking for the first time as he walks toward her. her heartbeat quickening, and a drum gently throbbing in her ears.